This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to, well, I'm afraid, plain old The Analyst Inside Cricket rather than at the World Cup. It's a week since the World Cup finished and we're all sort of coming down off it a bit, aren't we? And it's not the easiest thing to do, actually, even for people who've just worked on the sidelines.
No, it's amazing, actually. You build up and you're so wrapped up in the World Cup as well for so long, and then you build up, you have this amazing final, all the celebrations, and then the day afterwards, everything feels a bit flat, doesn't it? But there's so much to look forward to.
Life goes on.
Exactly. Well, life, hopefully. There's so much to look forward to. It's just a small matter of the Ashes. What we're going to do in this podcast, actually, hear from Matt Dawson, who won the World Cup, the Rugby World Cup, with England in 2003. And he talks about what it was like after winning the World Cup and how you sort of cope with life as a player after winning the World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite a hard thing. I just recall, you know, winning cups with Middlesex and, you know, the obviously, it's all relative. I mean, it wasn't a World Cup, but it still was a NatWest final, something which was quite a big thing in the 1980s and 90s. And, it, you know, you build to this crescendo and then you bowl the last over and there's all that kind of euphoria around it. And then certainly the next day, a few days after, especially if it's towards the end of the season, which those finals were as well, it does leave you feeling a bit flat and almost desolate, actually. And you want something else to be excited about. And I'm sure that is something that is going to be sort of hit a lot of these players. And actually, if you look at someone like Andrew Flintoff, 2005, obviously a national hero, winning the Ashes, incredible performance. Well, then a year or two later, he admitted to suffering from depression. Yeah. And actually, I think, you know, a lot of that was just major, mega disappointment because he could never reach those heights ever again. And it was a realisation that life was never going to be quite as exciting. And that's a hard thing to deal with.
Yeah. But the players somehow have got to get themselves up for an Ashes series. It's amazing, isn't it? We broke the cycle of Ashes into World Cup. Now we've got World Cup into Ashes. And normally, an Ashes summer is the biggest deal, isn't it? In English cricket, it's the biggest deal. And it doesn't feel like that at the moment because of the focus on the World Cup and the euphoria over the World Cup. But there's an Ashes to be regained. The Australians are over here preparing. I just wonder whether that will play into their hands a little bit. I mean, whether, you know, their disappointment and their determination to make up for what happened in the World Cup, I'm talking about Australia and England, well, they've already done their big deed of the summer, really. I remember, you know, talking to some of the players and asking them the question, you know, what would you rather win this summer? You know, you could only have one, Ashes or World Cup. And I don't think any of them said Ashes. You know, they said World Cup. Obviously, they said we'd like to win both. And there's that determination to win both. But, you know, it was that focus on winning the World Cup. World Cups, you know, get remembered forever and ever, don't they? Ashes, series, well, they do get remembered as well. But you sort of think, you have to think, hold on, what was what was 2000? You know, do you know what I mean? But as World Cup, you know the year you won the World Cup.
I suppose also Australia are extra motivated by the fact that they last won the Ashes in England in 2001. Yeah. So there is that sort of spark that they've got to kind of get over that massive hurdle of winning in England, which they haven't done since the era of Warner, McGrath and Ponting and Gilchrist and all those. So it's a major thing for them. And England sort of staving off that Aussie campaign will be tough, especially with players the likes of Stokes, Butler, Root, Wokes, Bairstow. You know, they've all had such an integral part of the World Cup, and it must take its toll.
Yeah, and you know, most of England's key players for the Ashes are their World Cup players, aren't they? They are the key. I mean, you think of some of the players that are going to come in. You know, Burns isn't playing the World Cup, and Denley. I mean, you wouldn't, if they do well in the Ashes, that's a real bonus for England. They're not their absolute key players, are they? You know, the ones they're really going to rely on. The only exception, really, or there's two exceptions, are Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad. You know, can they sort of lift the team up? Are they both going to play? That's the other thing as well. Jimmy Anderson's had this calf problem, might not play in the Test match against Ireland. Is he going to be able to play all five Test matches? England certainly hopes so, because he's, you know, a tremendous high-quality bowler. Is Stuart Broad going to play with Jimmy Anderson, or are they going to look to mix and match it? Or, you know, how many Test matches is Stuart Broad going to play this summer?
I can see Jofra Archer coming in for Broad, perhaps not for the first Test, because Archer may well need a bit more time to just recover from his side injury and all the kind of excitement around the World Cup. I think he's in Barbados at the moment having a bit of time off, which is a good idea. In the end, England are going to need that cutting edge, which Wood can't provide, because he's going to be out for probably most of the series. So Archer is seems to me a sort of perfect replacement for Stuart Broad, with that extra ingredient of pace as well. And Broad, I think, just, you know, his career's just tipped a little bit over the edge now. I know he's still a fine bowler, someone who'll be ultra motivated by the Ashes, but you sort of feel Anderson and Broad's time together is probably nearly at an end.
Yeah, well, they've been absolutely magnificent together, haven't they? I mean, they've been phenomenal for England, those two, and you know, all good things do come to an end. And what are we looking at? Jimmy Anderson's 37 at the end of the Ireland Test match. Stuart Broad is 33.
It's not old, is it, for 33?
No, but
I retired at 33.
Are they going to play? Do you see them playing four or five Test matches together this summer?
No, I think because, you know, firstly, because of their age, combined age, which is, what, 70? And also, just they're a bit too similar. I don't mean that they necessarily are exactly the same bowlers, but they look to do the same kind of things, which work a batsman round the crease, use the seam, clever ways. They're similar sort of pace. England need more variety. The pitches would probably be pretty flat. Talking of great players and how they manage to continue to motivate themselves and continue to keep that desire, I thought it was interesting to talk to Matt Dawson, the Rugby World Cup winner of 2003, and asked him particularly, how do you deal with the euphoria of winning the World Cup and the aftermath?
My initial thought was wanting to get back on the horse and get back to the somehow getting back to the euphoria of success, and whether that was with, you know, Northampton or England or the Lions, it spurred me on to, you know, that was obviously a goal for many, many years, but that was success at the highest level and I want more of it. Your mind tends to take over a little bit and think that you are slightly invincible. You know, a lot of us had dips in forms, lots of injuries. You know, there wasn't necessarily a formula for looking after the players who had won the World Cup. And the, you know, we'd just been solid. We'd been at it for probably two and a half years. There is a game to be played there, and players do have to be looked after mentally and physically, because you simply can't keep that up for a sustained period of time.
Well, and were you helped in any way?
I don't think I was. I was helped as much as I could have been, because it had never been done before. The scenarios of not just the playing and training, but all the appearances and the media, all the events, you know, everything. It was just relentless for so long, and you do take your eye off the ball. You know, there are so many positives, of course there are, but wanting to press on, you know, these world champions, individual teams who do it multiple times are significantly more adept at success than anybody else, because they have that ability to manage themselves after success to build themselves back up again.
Hmm.
Whereas I think certainly myself and I think a few others from 03, we just ploughed on and got a little bit giddy around the success that 03 was. Some of it was our fault, some of it wasn't, just by the circumstance, and you know, it didn't stand us in good stead for the sort of longevity of success.
So your advice to a, you know, Joss Butler, a Ben Stokes, somebody who was absolutely at the forefront of that World Cup win the other day, your advice to them going forward would be what?
They're harsh words, and not everyone around them is going to like it, but my advice is that they have to, if they don't already, they've got to develop a little bit of a selfish streak. They know themselves better than anybody else, any physio, any coach. You know, they're at the top of their game. They've proven they're world-class athletes, but they've got to be absolutely brutal with themselves about how they manage their bodies and their time. And that's, it's important that they spend time with their friends and their family, that they get grounded, but you know, they look after their bodies as well. Because it's really easy to say, do you know what, actually, yeah, you know, I've got 3 or 4 weeks off, but I'm ready after three, you know, I'm ready to come back. You know, I'd go the other way, I'd say, well, you get 3-4 weeks off, go in and say, I want 5 weeks off. Because as much as that seems an eternity, in the long run, they're the sorts of edges that are going to benefit you physically and mentally. And particularly with cricket, the way that, you know, it's such a mental strain on the individual and the team. They've got to be managed supremely well. And I think they probably are, certainly more than when we played. But, yeah, I always advise a little bit more of a selfish, ruthless streak that they'll benefit from in the long term.
It's been reported that English rugby didn't exploit to the full the success of 2003. Do you agree with that? And how could English cricket benefit from what they've achieved?
I would agree with that England not benefiting from it as a union, mainly because we were the first Northern Hemisphere team to do it. I think there was maybe a thought from the RFU that the sort of nut was cracked and everything was just going to be fine from then on. It needs a full breakdown and analysis as to, right, where can we take this? Let's not just sort of enjoy the parade and think that it's naturally going to happen and that kids are going to pick up the bat and bowl the ball and practice their fielding and do everything that they've seen these great players do over the last couple of months. But that will run out when the winter season comes, or you know, when the next time England don't do so well. And that infrastructure and that process has to be fully addressed and worked out and looked at other teams, other countries, and how they get that consistency. How do they flood the grassroots with coaching boys and girls how to not just play cricket but prepare for cricket, so that the next generation is absolutely knocking on the door for World Cups to come? Because you know, we got in 2003, we had an incredible bunch of individual players, some superstar names, and you don't always have that. But the great teams, the Germanys of this world in football, who always qualify and get there and thereabouts, New Zealand in the rugby, you know, it becomes the way of living your sport from when you're 6 or 7. And
a culture, really, isn't it?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah, and I suppose part of the part of the task behind cricket is going to be how they can get access to the talent, like rugby, you know, seen to be slightly sort of public school sport. You know, how do they get access and how do they nurture all the talent in the country and leverage all of those players and coaches and people that have been involved in the World Cup so that the word is spread not only wide, but for as long a period as possible, rather than just sort of, as I said, riding the crest of the wave that they're on at the moment.
So there's the star of Question of Sport, of course, Matt Dawson, turning the clock back to that amazing time in 2003 and giving some suggestions to some of these players, the England players. What do you think?
Well, not easy, is it? Just, I mean, he talked there about having time off, doesn't he? Saying, you know, you need time to recover, and being brutal, being selfish, and saying, look, I need to get away from it. And I think that's the big issue, I think. How do players who probably need a break, because it's not just 6 weeks, is it? They've been building up this, well, for 4 years, they had a four-year plan for a start, but they've been, you know, building up to it this year by, you know, playing series against Pakistan, against West Indies. It's all sort of been geared towards that sort of the summit, really, their Everest, of, you know, that World Cup final and winning. And then they suddenly, some of them are going to play against Ireland in a test match, which is a lead up to the Ashes. And there is no time for rest.
That's a real come down, isn't it? I mean, with due respect to Ireland, you're suddenly, you've been facing Mitchell Starc or Jasprit Bumrah or, you know, Lockie Ferguson in the World Cup final, and suddenly you're facing Tim Murta bowling 75 miles an hour from the nursery end, where he's an absolute master, by the way, brilliant bowler. That takes a completely different sort of mindset as well as technique.
Well, possibly a good opportunity for Ireland, you know, excellent opportunity for them to get into the England side, who might not be quite ready. There will be players in that England team, though, who... OK, there might be a few who are just below the required sort of mental, physical level you need to play a test match, but there'll be others who'll be very motivated. You know, the likes of Burns and Denley and Sam Curran. Sam Curran, by the way, who had a magnificent game against Australia A in that sort of warm-up game, half-century in both innings and six wickets. So, you know, there were players like that who can be really motivated. Ollie Stone and Lewis Gregory, if they get to play. So... That will probably mitigate against Ireland being able to take England by surprise. But that England team, it's a bit thin, isn't it, in the batting on paper. So if Ireland were to get a few early wickets, can they get enough runs against England's attack, which has been bolstered by the likes of, you know, Ollie Stone and Lewis Gregory? We don't quite know how they're going to configure the lineup. But Stone's an interesting one. I saw him playing in Sri Lanka last year. He's got some pace. Of course, he had that back injury. He's been out for a while. He's only just come back. Alistair Cook was saying that he played in the match against Essex for Warwickshire, and his match figures are not very flattering. He's about 240 in the game. But he said, you know, he's by far the quickest bowler on display. Now, you could see what England see in him.
Mm, and they think they definitely need it, don't they? Because they're not going to have Wood and they're not going to have Archer. So the other seamers that are in the squad, Wokes, Curran, Anderson, Broad, even Stokes when he comes back, they're all of a sort of pace. So it's good to have somebody else who just gives you that extra thrust. A great opportunity for Stone, if he plays in that Irish Test match, to then suggest an opportunity in the Ashes and give the Australians a bit of hurry up before the Archer and possibly Wood come back into the side later.
Just picking up on some of the other things that Matt Dawson said there, he said you do take your eye off the ball, and I, if there is a come down for England, I think it will be understandable, some of those players who can't quite, you know, reach the same levels that they've been reaching in the last few weeks. I mean, it's possible the Ashes is enough to sustain you, but I mean, it's a grueling experience, isn't it? That tough, intense battle over 4 or 5 days, over 6 weeks, five test matches, and against a really competent Australian side as well. That seems to sort of damn them with faint praise. I mean, they're good enough to come here and win for the first time since 2001. And they've got enough in their armoury, and I get a sense of them as well. You're really preparing well. They've been over here for quite a long time. They've been, you know, playing lots of warm up matches. They're going to play against themselves, aren't they, Australia against Australia A down in Southampton, which is almost like a shootout for the for test places. So that it feels as if they're preparing well. I think, you know, one of the issues has been, you know, for Ashes series or any tour really, is that preparation time in the past. You know, you've played loads of games leading up to the first test, not the case anymore. But they look like a side who really got themselves together here. Whether they're good enough, we'll see when that Duke's ball is nipping around a bit, whether their techniques are strong enough. But it feels like a big challenge for England this summer.
Yeah, and obviously Smith and Warner coming back into the Australia side as well will galvanise them and galvanise individuals. They'll be both extremely determined. I suppose, you know, going back to Matt Dawson again, that what he picked out was the incredible desire and motivation of certain countries, their ability to constantly compete for the major trophies, the Germanys, the All Blacks, etc. And also, he didn't mention this, but the individuals, yeah, the likes of Federer and Nadal and Djokovic, and how they keep getting themselves up. Yeah. Because it's incredible, isn't it?
It is.
Maybe it's easier in an individual sport where you've got no one else to rely on. In a team sport, cricket, football, where, you know, if you're slightly off colour, somebody else might step in, and there's a temptation there to perhaps not always give it, you try and improve and develop, and because you're not necessarily going to just benefit yourself, you can rely on other people.
Mm. It's about that thing, about, isn't it, about peaking week after week. I suppose footballers are asked to peak week after week. You know, Manchester City, for example, set extremely high standards for themselves. You know, they've got very good players, but they have to keep producing week after week after week. Well, and it's not even just week after week, is it? Sometimes it's Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday, and you're talking about 9 months, and the best, the very best, are able to do it.
What about the legacy of the World Cup and England's triumph? Because a lot has been made about the importance of the free-to-air exposure, obviously of England winning it, the dramatic final moments, 8 million people watching on TV, the probably about four times the biggest audience that cricket's had for the last 10, 15 years, almost back to those days of 2005, the Ashes. But somehow, it's important. It's a watershed moment. It's a defining moment for cricket, because the aftermath of the 2005 Ashes did not result in more people playing the game. Well, it did in a short term for the first couple of years, but then after that there was a real drop-off, and participation and, to a lesser extent, general interest in cricket is now at an all-time low, or it was before the World Cup, because mainly cricket has been sort of hidden behind a paywall for much of the time. And though the BBCs and Sky have done their best, in the end, you know, it's become a lesser sport in national perception. So what do we do now to try and capitalise on that great success of the World Cup? Clearly, the number one priority is to get more kids playing cricket in state schools. Mm. That's my view. And at the moment, it's 12%. 12% of kids play cricket in state schools. Tom Harrison says it's 22%. And that, I think, includes the private schools. But in state schools, it's 12%. And that's just woeful. So it means over three quarters of under-16s don't really understand cricket. Mm.
You've got to play at a young age. I mean, you've got to be introduced to it in your schools. I mean, I know the clubs do a fantastic job trying to, yeah, in certain areas, don't they, where there is that sort of groundswell of support for the game. And we've touched on this on this podcast before. You know, there are certain clubs and certain areas of the country where, you know, cricket is really thriving, but it's patchy. I mean, I have to say, I'm a bit sceptical about a moment like...
Surely not.
Well, a bit sceptical about a moment like Sunday suddenly sort of leading to a sort of a revolution in cricket playing and cricket interest.
Well, it kick-starts.
I agree.
Something.
No, I agree.
Or can do.
I agree. And then you have to capitalise it.
There's a realisation that from people who... I mean, I've met lots of people, as I'm sure you have over the last week, who said, I didn't realise cricket was so exciting. Mm. Of course, it isn't. In fact,
That's the point, isn't it?
But I equate following cricket a bit like bringing up kids, actually. There's a lot of drudgery and hard work, yeah, and tiring mornings and evenings. and the occasional highlight when something, you know, someone gets a great result or they win the sack race or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, there are beautiful moments when you bring up kids, and there are beautiful moments when you support cricket, but there's a lot of drudgery involved as well. And it's almost getting people to understand that, but that there are these incredible highs. And it's a game that's just really good for you, isn't it, in so many ways. But it's kind of getting that message across.
Yeah.
So, listen, I'd just like to invite you, the listeners, to give us your own suggestions. Sebastian Coe actually was on the radio the other day talking about the legacy of the World Cup win and the importance of government joined up thinking to try and get more sport stroke cricket in schools, and also to make more facilities available, to get more parks or school grounds, private school grounds perhaps, available for the community to play cricket. Now, give us your own suggestions about what England might do, the ECB might do, or the government might do to try and encourage more participation and interest. There is a small reward for the three or four
best answers. It is only very small.
which is a copy of my new book, Cricket's Greatest Rivalry, A History of the Ashes in 12 Matches, which is out now. And I'm happy to send three or four of you who've come up with some sensible suggestions.
Well, the best suggestions, I think that's what we were. We're looking
the
for
best that. Suggestions yeah, the for best what, suggestions. What the game can do to capitalise on that great World Cup moment. Send your ideas into theanalystpodcast@gmail.com, and I promise I will send two or three of you a copy of this book, which is actually quite enjoyable. It was enjoyable to write.
Even though you say so yourself.
Well, it was enjoyable to write anyway. Hopefully it'll be enjoyable to read. It's a history of the Ashes, picking on 12 great matches from 1882, the creation of the Ashes, to the last game, which was Stuart Broad's 8 for 15, I think,
yeah,
wasn't it?
8 for 15.
8 for 15 at Trent Bridge in 2015.
The only point I was going to make is that it wasn't... I think it is important that the game capitalises on what happened on Sunday. But my point, I think, is that just every now and again in life, that something happens that just makes you go, wow. And it's almost live for that moment. Do you know what I mean? Live for that moment and cherish it. It doesn't always have to be a next step. Sometimes it's just a moment in itself to really enjoy and relish. And, you know, when you're in 40 years' time, just to look back on and think, oh, I was there that day. I saw that. It wasn't that incredible. It's not.
But
what
don't
it,
you want other people to share
I do,
it, though?
I do. But of course I do. Of course I do.
In the future.
What I'm saying is I think it's just sometimes it's about a moment to cherish as well. It's just one of those great moments in time. And, yeah, it would be fantastic if more people came to the game. And it is an opportunity. I agree. I'm not saying don't take the opportunity. But I think sometimes we just lose the beauty of the moment in that desire always to think about the future. And, you know, this is, oh, now we've done this. We've got to grow the game. You know, it was all the talk was about. There was a lot of talk the day afterwards and in the week afterwards about legacy. And that's right. But also just about, wow, what a moment that was.
And it really was. It was amazing. And I've got a little funny little story to tell you about that, actually, because my son, one of my sons, who will be nameless, was there in the pavilion watching the final moments. And he was sat in the committee room, which is normally my spot, but he was sort of sitting in for me during the day because I was working on TV. Near the end, he wanted to get outside because he was inside in the committee room watching through the big window. And he wanted to get outside and sort of share in this amazing atmosphere. So he asked the nearest person in the committee room, just very politely, you know, excuse me, am I allowed to go outside? And the person replying said, I'm afraid I'm not actually able to answer that question. And it was Prince Andrew, who he hadn't quite dawned on was there in their midst.
Well, I think Agus actually didn't realise, because he was out there doing the presentation of the World Cup, when he was at live, you know, on the ground doing, you know, presenting the coverage on Five Live, and he said, I think, did he say some chap's handing over the World Cup? I'm pretty sure he said something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. So tell us how you've been spending the week post the World Cup, because you said you've had a conversation with an umpire.
Well, Monday I went for a walk with a friend of mine, and he is a qualified umpire, and we talked about the overthrow, and both of us came to, you know, said, you know, if we'd have been umpire, I'm not a qualified umpire, but I mean, I, you know, played club cricket for years and watched cricket for years, and if that had happened in a game in which I'd been playing, I would just expect his six runs to be added to the score. But, you know, a close examination of the laws, I think, does suggest it should have been five. umpire Damascena has said he doesn't regret his decision. They considered it at the time. They weren't allowed to refer it, which strikes me as being odd. You know, they couldn't go upstairs and just check on TV whether they crossed. But you heard Mireille Erasmus, didn't you, on Sunday evening say, you know, they were checking to see whether they crossed and discussing whether they crossed. I have to say, I mean, it's weird because if the ball had hit the bat, well, it did hit the bat, but hit the bat just gone away for, you know, to a fielder, it would have been two runs, wouldn't it? So to me, the law was sort of illogical. A lot of people say, oh, you know, England only won because of that. Well, we don't know that because, you know, Stokes might have hoofed one out of the park, or the last ball might have been hoofed out of the park for four or six. So, you know, we don't know it definitely affected the result. What did affect the result was more the interception that went for four. And that you might say, well, you know, needs, a lot of people said to me, there should be a law change about that. You know, it should be dead ball if the ball hits the bat.
So what you're saying is that while everybody else in the week after the World Cup was championing England and treasuring the result and all that, you were walking the dog, talking to an old umpire about an extra run.
Yeah,
you really need to get a life.
Well, I thought you said get out a bit. I was out a bit. I was out in the wilds of northeast London, but. Well, I just thought it was just a really interesting moment. Just on the tiebreaker. I had actually not too many problems. A lot of people said, oh, you know, you can't, you know, decide a World Cup on boundaries. I had less problem with that. I had more, I think, more problem with the sort of that incident, you know, the run that was given England and the overthrow incident. I didn't feel satisfactory. I felt New Zealand were really hard done by. It would be great to see a World Cup settled in what you might describe as a just way. But I didn't mind the boundary count. You know, everyone knew what the tiebreaker was going into that super over. So you're all playing to the same rules, you know.
But in a way, if you're going to go to the super over and it's still a tie, surely go to another super over.
Well, yeah,
and
whatever.
If you're worried about timing, well, wasting time, the team that batted last can bat first.
Well, I don't have an issue with it being a different sort of tiebreaker, but the point was, is everyone knew what the tiebreaker was, so we're playing to those, you know, rules in that super over. So I didn't really have a problem with that. I did feel it was a bit, it was unsatisfactory the way England managed to get to the tie initially. It was a complete fluke, and I mean, in a way, it sort of added to the lustre of the situation, really, the excitement of the situation. I was just thinking, actually, imagine if that had been, you know, we probably see it in a different way because we're English, but imagine if that had been David Warner diving for his ground and deflected that ball over the boundary for four, and then Australia had gone on to beat England in the World Cup
final.
Well,
Warner wouldn't have been allowed back in the pavilion, would he? That people would have barred the gates and he'd had to walk round the back or something.
So just imagine if it had been that in those circumstances. So you can understand how New Zealand felt.
And actually, they dealt with it incredibly well. There was great magnanimity from New Zealand. And somebody was saying to me today that they seem to be like that in all sports. You know, they just won the Netball World Cup, obviously. But, you know, they consistently win the Rugby World Cup. And there's never an issue with New Zealand bad behaviour. I know, you know, very occasionally one of the rugby players might be accused of something, a bit of skullduggery, but you don't ever hear of bad behaviour and sort of penalty points and, I don't know, sort of demerit points and things for New Zealand cricketers, do you? It seems like they just have this way of playing sport, which is hard but fair.
But do you think there should be a law change then? You know, if the ball hits the bat, that's dead ball.
I do, yeah. I think that's quite right.
Because the batsmen don't run, do they?
Unless, of course, the bat is clearly deliberately obstructing the ball, and then it's going to be obstructing the field.
That's different, yeah. If you change the
But if it's
line
an accidental
run, yeah.
interception...
If it's an accidental interception...
It should be dead ball.
Yeah.
You're right. So while you were wandering about with an umpire looking through the laws of the game, I spent 2 days in the cricketer offices of the magazine, trying to work out who we put on the front cover or what picture we put on the front cover, because there were so many heroes and so many great moments from the World Cup. So we in the end, we had 12...
Kumar Damascena and Mireille Erasmus?
Yes, quite. We Prince Andrew, maybe. We had 12 possible covers, and do you know what we did? We chose all of them.
Oh, right.
So there actually are 12 covers of the Cricketer magazine, which is out this week. It's a commemorative issue of the World Cup. with 30-odd pages of coverage and your own choice of cover. So whoever is your favourite player or someone that you've really admired during that tournament, there is a cover to reflect that. Although I'm sorry that people like James Vince didn't get their own cover, but just the final 11 have got a cover each. Talk of the Cricketer reminds me, by the way, that there's a special offer with the magazine this month. For £20, you can get 13 issues, including this great commemorative one, the World Cup win. And if you just go to thecricketer.com, there's all the details there for a special offer, £20 for a year's subscription to The Cricketer. Pretty good value, that.
Well, I look forward to looking at that and reading it.
What a week for Irish sport. So Owen Morgan raises the World Cup one Sunday. Shane Lowry raises the claret jug the next Sunday. And Ireland are now playing a test match at Lord's. So it's quite a few days, or a couple of weeks, for Irish sport, isn't it?
Imagine if they win as well.
Win at Lord's. Yeah. So on Saturday at Lord's, they hold up... There'll be a trophy, I suppose, for the one-off Irish test. I mean, they've played two previous tests without a great deal of success. Obviously lost to Pakistan this time last year. Can they compete, do you think? I mean, obviously somebody like Tim Murtagh will be very effective, but no real pace to threaten the English batsman with. There's a lot to play. Well, Jason Roy opening the test match for the first time. What an opportunity for him.
Yeah. As I was saying earlier, I think there's a lot to motivate the England team, those players who weren't in the World Cup squad. So I don't think Ireland will be coming up against an England hangover in that sense, because quite a few players are missing. But I'd be surprised if Ireland... overturned England at Lords.
They're fairly weak, aren't they? They haven't got really one outstanding player. They've got a lot of sort of workman-like players. Andy Balburnie, number three, has made a couple of decent centuries in international cricket, so he's certainly one to look out for. But apart from him, you sort of feel that the players like William Porterfield, Kevin O'Brien, they've been around a long time now, and they just haven't quite raised their game to international level.
The other thing as well, it's a 4-day match as well, and the possibility of some heavy rain later in the week. It's going to get really hot in London, then some thunderstorms. So it may well be that the weather has a bit of a say as well. But I wonder how England will play it, actually, because it is a different sort of game, isn't it? It's a four-day test match rather than a 5-day test match. So you might have to get on with it a bit and force the issue a bit if you want to win the match.
And it's a good test of whether four-day cricket works, four-day test cricket, actually. See if they can finish the overs in time and get a result. I think the average test match lasts something like 340 overs, so there is the potential 360 overs in those 4 days. So they should get a result, provided the weather doesn't intervene. OK, well, just a reminder that to give us your ideas about the future of the game and how the ECB and others can utilise that great World Cup success, send your answers to theanalystpodcast@gmail.com.
And we'll read out the best ones next week.
So no rest for the wicked. I'm back on duty on Wednesday.
I'm going on holiday.
Very wise. Have a good run.
Thanks very much. Speak to you soon.
Thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.